looking for the breaks in Gaza.
All this must stop. Both Israel and Hamas must halt their acts of violence and take all necessary measures to avoid civilian casualties.
The UN Secretary General and the international community find little in the way of leverage in the Gaza violence. More civilian dead, no end in sight. Israel and the Palestinians go their own way on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 30th, and we do have the latest on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Also today, we'll take a look inside an environmental disaster down south and the brewing disaster for retailers. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
No end in sight. That's the Israel-Hamas conflict in four words, and here's Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev with a few more.
All the reports were that Hamas was in shock and that Hamas had received very strong blows from us. But we have no doubt that the Hamas military machine is still very much there, that they are still lethal, and there's still a problem.
The problem Regev is referring to is Hamas rockets targeting Israel. Those haven't fully stopped yet, and since the Israeli assault began on Saturday, four Israelis have died. But many more Palestinians are dead. The UN says the Gaza death toll tops 360 since Saturday, with many more injured. Among the wounded is this woman's father.
I've never imagined that the streets that I took on my way to school is bombarded heavily. I never imagined that these streets will be full of dead bodies of innocent children, women, and men. It's a nasty feeling, and it's killing me.
As you heard at the top of the hour there, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called on Israel and Hamas to stop the fighting that has killed so many civilians.
Today, there's word of a major Pakistani offensive against Islamic militants in the northwest province of Pakistan. Pakistan has closed a major supply road to prepare for the attack, reportedly. It's not clear how long the assault will last. More bailout dollars are heading to the auto industry. The Treasury Department will pump $5 billion into GMAC, that's GM's financial arm, the folks who give out car loans. Plain old GM gets a separate billion-dollar loan to invest in GMAC.
The Northeast and the Midwest may have to ring in 2009 in the dark. High winds have knocked out power lines and cut electricity for thousands in the state of Michigan and parts of New York State. In the Midwest, they're bracing for floods. Here's Daniel Cobb with the National Weather Service on the water situation in Michigan.
We have 13 warnings out for various river forecast points, mostly along the Grand River, which is the river that flows through Grand Rapids.
Several other Midwest states besides Michigan could be flooding.
To money news, where European markets are mostly up, Asian markets had a fairly good day, with most indexes closing higher. Trading was fairly light since many investors are done for the year.
It's expected Wall Street will open positively. The S&P begins trading at 869. So retailers have basically one more day
to figure out how to get us into the stores, because the sales numbers are dismal. You are not shopping. What would it take to get you into the store? Do they have to give away things for free? Is it 70% off, 80%, 90% off?
20% off? What is it? Do you need a bonus like the Marine Corps is offering to recruits to get you into the retail shops? 877-8-MY-TAKE. What's it going to take, folks?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The signs are everywhere. Rising civilian death counts, rising casualties on both sides, calls for a cessation of hostilities at the UN and around the world, and even the rollout of graphics calling for another crisis or describing another crisis in the Middle East on cable news networks around the world. But it looks as though the crisis between Israel and Hamas in Gaza is going to go on for some time. No sign of any cessation of hostilities. And to discuss both what's going on in Israel and Gaza this morning and what the reaction is in the region are Ethan Bronner, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times, Times, who joins us from Jerusalem. Ethan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John.
And from the BBC, Jim Muir, the Beirut bureau chief for the BBC. Jim Muir, thanks for being with us.
Most welcome.
Ethan, let's begin with you. The talk of humbling Hamas and destroying its lethality seems to be the theme of statements coming out of the Israeli government this morning. Is there any indication of a threshold that might cause them to declare this a military success in some way? Or is there a specific military objective in that you've been able to decipher?
I'm afraid that it's unclear. I don't think that there's any talk of a slowdown or a stop. This is something that they have had in their pocket and been thinking about for many months. And, you know, it's constant reference to the 2006 war against Hezbollah. And it's important to remember that for outsiders and certainly for the Lebanese, what was most distinctive about that campaign was Israel's level of aggression, that it was extraordinarily high. In Israel, the opposite view is held, that the failure of the Lebanon war in 2006 was a result of its restraint. So therefore, the view here is that they are not going to show restraint, that this is going to go on for some time.
What are the differences, though, in the battlefield? I mean, we talked to your colleague yesterday in Gaza who was describing the impact of this so-called targeted bombing campaign in one of the most densely populated areas in the world. And we're not talking about the hills of southern Beirut in this kind of a campaign.
Well, actually, southern Beirut is extremely densely populated, and I think when you talk to Jim in a minute, there's no question that there were an enormous number of Lebanese civilian casualties in 2006 as well. They're very similar situations in the sense that these are guerrilla, quote-unquote, people's armies, in many ways impossible to distinguish from the general population. Today, for example, in Gaza City, there was a bombing at an apartment in a building just 100 meters from my colleague where she was sleeping. So, you know, it's all over the place. It's very similar to what was going on in southern Beirut.
Jim, how would you describe the similarities or differences between what happened in 2006 and what's going on now in Gaza?
I think you're right to suggest that Gaza is more densely populated. A lot of the trouble in 2006 affected south Lebanon as opposed to the southern suburbs of Beirut. Obviously, when they hit the south of Beirut itself, that is very densely populated, although people knew it was going to happen, so they cleared away from potential targets. But a lot of the casualties were in the south, where buildings were knocked down in villages and towns throughout the area. But it is a much more dispersed area, so it's going to be much harder for them to use that kind of air power in Gaza without killing, I think, proportionally a lot more people than were killed in general in South Lebanon as a whole. I think there are a lot of similarities. Obviously, main one being, I think, that despite Israel's awesome air power, it can't really hope to get to the root of the problem with air power alone. It will have to go in on the ground, and it may even have to stay in if it's actually to clear up, because nobody believes Israel won the war in 2006. Hezbollah is still in a position to fire rockets. Hezbollah is still there. If Israel had intended to root out Hezbollah, it certainly failed.
And so that certainly begs the question, what would Hamas consider a victory? What is success to them, Ethan? Is it Israeli troops coming in on the ground?
I think in some ways that, yes, it is that would be at least a measure of victory for them, because you can't fight against air power. You can't stop them. You can't take your pound of flesh. When you have Israeli soldiers in front of you, you have a chance of fighting back, and that's certainly what they're hoping for on some level. Like Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, there are a lot of tunnels and a lot of sort of byways that they have worked out in preparation and waiting for this ground offensive. But I think that, again, what would be a victory for them would be simply to be still standing when it's over and to have seen to have withstood and acted as leader of the resistance against the Zionist oppression.
But Ethan, not meaning to sound argumentative, that would be the opposite outcome of what Hezbollah achieved in Lebanon, where the Israelis actually withdrew. In this particular case, they would yearn for an actual reoccupation of Gaza as some sort of military victory?
No, I don't mean a reoccupation. I think a rather similar situation, which is that after some weeks, there would be a deal where Israel leaves. I mean, Israel, again, that's what happened in 2006 in Lebanon, and Hezbollah was still standing. I mean, Israel argues that it wasn't such a defeat because there has not been a single rocket that has come into Israel in the 2.5 years since. That's what it claims all it's looking for from the situation in Gaza.
Jim Muir, here is the sound of some protesters in Damascus as there's been reaction around the world of to what's going on in Gaza. Listen to this. In some sense, Jim, the reaction is not surprising at all, but is there any sort of character of the waiting game in the Arab world as they take a look at what's going on in Gaza?
I think that there is quite a lot of popular sentiment rising, and I think Arab leaders are getting wind of that. Egypt, for example, here in Lebanon, Hezbollah has staged a couple of big rallies and some fiery speeches. I think that the key question really is whether Hezbollah feels eventually pressured by its own ideology, in a way, to do something, as it did indeed in 2006, that could provoke a conflict with Israel, between Israel and Lebanon, because that's what happened in 2006. They staged that cross-border provocation, took a couple of Israeli soldiers prisoner, precisely in order to relieve a very similar Israeli pressure on Gaza. So they must be feeling that pressure internally, at least. A lot may depend on what decisions are taken in Tehran, because according to some senior ex-Hezbollah officials, it's Tehran that calls the shots when it comes to decision-making inside Hezbollah. That's certainly some view, a strong view. So I think, the longer this situation goes on, the more dangerous it will get.
Well, then here's a question for both of you, and I'll begin with you, Jim. Is there anybody on the regional stage or even in the sort of traditional group of brokers of Middle East peace that is capable of doing what seems to be at the absolute minimum what is required for some sort of diplomatic outcome here, and that is to create a unified Palestinian front to negotiate with Israel? Anybody capable of producing that kind of a consensus among the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza?
That's very difficult because it is so fragmented, and in a way American policy is being seen writ out on the ground here, because the Americans did not welcome the election of Hamas in Gaza in 2006, and obviously have been doing everything they could to try and bring Hamas down. So it is a situation where the obvious brokers, the Americans, are not in a position to do that brokering, and that is the big issue, really. Who is capable of pressuring Israel to kind of scale down its operations? Who is going to get some deal brokered with the Palestinians? That could be an Egyptian role, but the cards have to be in the right configuration for that to happen. One interesting point from a British point of view is that the British are not following the Americans blindly, as they did in 2006, where Mr. Blair was not calling for an immediate ceasefire. The British are now calling for an immediate ceasefire. So the US is really out in the open as the only power, just basically blaming Hamas and saying to the Israelis, get on with it.
Yeah, it's hard to hear a quartet in this music. Ethan Bronner, you want to run down the broker sort of status?
Sure.
From your perspective?
I think that, there is an outside shot for Turkey, which has been playing a role between Israel and Syria. And I think that what Jim says about the American administration is quite right, although, of course, we're on the cusp of a new administration. And it seems from at least the essays that have been written by likely advisors to the incoming administration, they are less eager to see division between Hamas and Fatah. And there is a lot of talk in these sort of papers that have been prepared about seeking some kind of ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and a reconciliation between Fatah, or anyway the Palestinian administration in the West Bank, and Hamas of Gaza. So it's pretty grim at the moment, but it does seem like in a month that could conceivably change.
Well, that's a lot to digest. Ethan Bronner, thanks so much for joining us, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times, and Jim Muir, our pal from the BBC, reporting from Beirut. Thank you, Jim and Ethan.
My pleasure.
Good
very much.
You.
Very much to digest. That's the first I've heard of Turkey being involved.
That would be a fascinating development, but maybe that's what it needs, is someone else.
In a month, we may be in a totally different zone, as Ethan says.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Maybe I'm just a small town guy or something, but when I see going out of business signs in store windows, I always think to myself, if I just shopped there, maybe they wouldn't be in such trouble. It's all me, but consumers aren't buying, and there's just a day to make up for the dismal sales year. Tell us, what would get you out shopping?
Hi, this is Jim Royce from West Springfield, Massachusetts. What would get me out of the house is a decline in prices in the service sector, not just the retail sector. Somebody who doesn't spend much, if any, money on product, the inelasticity of prices in the service market have kept me sitting on my hands.
Very interesting. Tell us your wish list at 877-8-MY-TAKE, your threshold to get back into the retail market, or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
Well, Jim is certainly not alone. A lot of people are sitting on their hands, and they're not shopping. The new year hasn't even started, and already retail bankruptcies have begun. Stephanie Rosenblum from our partners, The New York Times, has been covering the story, and she joins us now. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Well, retailers, they were certainly crossing their fingers through this holiday season, hoping that, beyond hope, that the sales would be okay, but they've been dismal, right?
Yes, they have. They really have. It's been one of the weakest holiday seasons in decades.
And so many were expecting that the bankruptcies would begin after the new year, that after suffering through what is two of the most important months for retailers, November and December, that many retailers just weren't going to be able to move forward. And you profile the parent company, which filed on Monday before 2009.
Yes, that's right. And there were some companies, too, you know, Circuit City, for one, that filed, you know, before Christmas. But in terms of well-known retailers, you know, eToys, which, you know, is a subsidiary of parent company, was, you know, one of the first big ones.
Well, give us the anatomy of what went wrong for them. And was it just the dismal sales, or did it have something to do with their business model in this kind of economy?
This economy is very interesting because if there was any weakness in your company before this downturn, it was tremendously exacerbated. And people who, you know, sort of didn't get in early and begin restructuring were the ones that are sort of feeling it the most. And they've had some problems in the past. I mean, eToys, had filed, you know, for bankruptcy protection in 2001, and its assets were bought by KB Toys, which, you know, is one of the nation's biggest toy retailers. And, you know, they have filed for bankruptcy twice, and the second time was this month. So, you know, and they're now in the process of, you know, going out of business sales. So there were some issues beforehand, but, you know, the economy plays a huge part in all of this.
And talking about weaknesses before this horrific economy kicked in, you talk about the survey that was done by Alex Partners, the restructuring firm that estimates that over the next 2 years, there will be a fourfold increase in the number of retailers in deep distress. Why?
Well,
specifically.
And I don't have Alex Partners, you know, their full model and all the reasons, but, you know, essentially what they're looking at is, you know, retailers who have, let's say, a high debt load, who do not have enough cash to keep, you know, paying their operating expenses day to day. And they're saying if these retailers, you know, keep going as they are, this is what will happen, you know, over the next 24 months. There are some companies, you know, that sort of started early trying to trim, let's say, the number of stores they had or cut down on their staff or, you know, just basically trim the fat, you know, that the company had been operating with. And, you know, this is a moment where the companies that get lean will emerge from this very strong. But, you know, it's a matter of could you get in there fast enough? Could you turn your inventory into cash that you can use, you know, to pay off your debt and to pay those, you know, day-to-day expenses.
I was struck in your article by the fact that the parent company is actually an online retailer, and on the whole, online retailers, although their sales were down in many cases, not nearly as down as other retail providers.
That's right. That's right. I mean, there, you know, if anyone can say there's something of a bright spot anywhere, it has been online. And but, you know, not all online companies are immune, obviously. And certainly, you know, one thing we're learning from this downturn is, you know, all sectors, I mean, even sectors like luxury that people thought at one point were, you know, very well insulated from downturns, we're seeing that that is no longer the case. You know, this is an entirely different set of rules.
If I pull out my Yellow Pages and kind of go down the list of retailers, I'm wondering if the easy sort of distinction as to who's going to make it in the next 6 months and who's not is who's lined up the credit lines to actually maintain their cash flow. If you've got it, like, say, Sears seems to have, you might be okay. If you don't, you're just out in the cold.
Right, and that's why, you know, a lot of companies are having, you know, very serious discussions right now, you know, trying to, you know, make sure that they have that money lined up, you know, and those that don't, you know, it's going to be very difficult for them. And you know, they all know now, essentially, where they stand and, you know, what steps they're going to have to take. I mean, obviously, at all costs, they try to, you know, avoid having to go into bankruptcy protection, but unfortunately, it's unavoidable.
The other bright spot, the last question here quickly, is Walmart. Somehow they managed to buck the trend in an enormous way.
In a huge way, yeah. This is a Walmart Christmas, without a doubt. You know, I mean, they had started overhauling their, you know, making changes to their operations, you know, improving their stores, you know, a couple years ago. And their message of having, you know, rock bottom prices is suddenly resonates at this moment, you know, more than it ever has before. So they were just in the sweet spot there. And, you know, as their chief executive Lee Scott said recently at a meeting, this is Walmart time. And it's true.
It's Walmart time. Rock bottom prices. That's what brings in shoppers. Thanks very much, Stephanie Rosenblum.
Thank you.
Stephanie Rosenblum is a reporter for our partners at The New York Times. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got the headlines.
And the time is 28 minutes past the hour. Most Asian stock markets rose today. Japan's Nikkei index went up more than 1%. So it was a good day for Japan, but a bad year. At the end of their final day of trading, the Nikkei index closed down more than 42% for the year. And that's the worst ever one-year drop. Billionaire investor Kurt Kerkorian has given up on Ford Motor Company. Now, according to a spokesman for his investment company, he sold his remaining shares in the automaker. He owned almost 5%. And this comes just 6 months after he spent $1 billion boosting its stake in the company. Tennessee residents close to the site of a major coal ash spill should stop drinking water from private wells. The water supplies from the city are still safe to drink. And we'll hear more about this story just coming up in a few minutes' time. Thailand's new prime minister delivered a key policy speech this morning. That's in spite of the presence of thousands of protesters at the parliament building in Bangkok. RP sit Away Chichiwa said that his goal is to bridge the country's political divide, and the latest demonstrators support the exiled former prime minister. And that's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We're asking for your help today, or rather ways that you can help retailers. You haven't been shopping much. The sales, the holiday sales, were dismal this year. But there are 2 days left in the shopping year. What would it take to get you in a store?
You know what's going to take for me to get into the store is money. I don't have any money. They're bailing out everybody else, but they don't bail out the little people. Plus, the stores, it's a gimmick. You go in there, and it's 80% off, but when you look at the original pricing, what they're charging you in the register, it's not 80% off.
Okay, she's not buying those sales. What's your story, 8778-MYTAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org? Tell us why you're not shopping.
So they're calling it a spill, but it looks more like a gigantic landslide down there in Tennessee, and it is as devastating and covers as vast a region as a major flood. A little over a week ago, more than 1 billion gallons of wet coal ash spilled after a retaining wall ruptured or overtopped or something. They actually don't know exactly what it is, 40 miles west of Knoxville, Tennessee. The spill coated parts of eastern Tennessee in more than 5.4 million cubic yards of toxic sludge. It's from the burning of coal for electrical energy. And now the Tennessee Valley Authority, the utility, has to figure out how to get rid of it all. Josh Florey is a reporter for the Knoxville News Sentinel. He joins us from the studios of WUOT in Knoxville. And he's just been to the site of this sludge spill, landslide, whatever you want to call it. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, guys.
Give us a sense of what it looks like to actually be in this area. I mean, these are places where people live, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the word that you hear used to describe it often is a moonscape. What you got is almost concrete-looking sludge, very gray, wet material. It's spilled out of this retaining wall and actually swept one house off of its foundation. And I was out there yesterday. You can see it, another house right there, and the sludge is partially buried a house. So there's a lot of this material, and obviously has left a big mess for TVA to clean up.
Now, people in Knoxville know TVA pretty well and have been living near the sort of huge projects that are associated with the TVA. Did anyone have a sense that they were as vulnerable as they apparently are from this kind of a spill?
I think absolutely not. It's taken people by surprise, the fact that this could happen. I think it's taken TVA by surprise, certainly. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Josh.
Well, they've said that they didn't have any way of predicting that this could happen.
What's in the sludge? It's actually very dangerous material.
Well, what it is, essentially, as you see a big power plant with a smokestack that's got smoke coming out of it, the sludge is the material that's taken out of that smoke. And so it's kind of a powdery ash, and it does have trace elements of heavy metals, things like arsenic, which has been the main concern, the health concern for folks that live in this area. But it's kind of basically a powder that's mixed at this site with water, and so it forms kind of a sludgy material. But, yeah, the heavy metals are the things that, even though it is small amounts, that have caused the most concern for residents in this area.
And chemically, it's basically the exact same material that airborne has caused the acid rain crisis in the Northeast that killed fish in places like Vermont and New Hampshire, right?
You know, I'm not sure about that, but it certainly is material that they're trying to take out of this smoke before it goes into the air. So it's stuff that does cause a concern that they don't want it getting out into the air. And actually now we've got some dry days in the forecast. There have been a lot of rain in the last week, and so one of the concerns for TVA now is trying to make sure that as the material that's on the ground dries out, that it doesn't get kicked up by the wind and sent into the air where people will be breathing it in.
You know, Josh, one of the great ironies in this whole thing is that this is happening in the town that is the home of Al Gore, Mr., you know, global warming and let's reduce carbon emissions. Is there a sense that this kind of a catastrophe is a consequence of the scale at which we are burning coal in this environment right now, that coal is certainly you know, in the crosshairs for electric power all over the United States as fuel prices have fluctuated and the oil markets up and down in the way that they have?
Well, I think the former vice president was from a little bit farther west here from Middle Tennessee, but certainly what you're seeing here in East Tennessee is you got national groups and some activist groups that are seeing this as an opportunity, a perfect example of the case they're trying to make that they're, what they say is there is no such thing as clean coal. And so that even when you can clean up the emissions and the smoke that's coming out of the smokestacks, you still are left behind with this material that you have to figure out what to do with. And so they make the case that it's still dangerous even after you clean up the emissions, and that this spill is kind of an example of that, that what you're seeing now is the threat possibly to groundwater. And so certainly I think that there are groups that are using this as an opportunity to kind of bolster their case in that regard.
particularly as to lined landfills. Can you describe what the sludge was contained in before the wall came down and forced this flood, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, and I was trying to think of an analogy for this, and the best one I could come up with, y'all can tell me if this works or not, but it's sort of like a cake pan. You've got earthen walls, and so they form almost like a cake pan, and if you think of this powder that's mixed with water as cake batter, it gets poured into this pan that's made out of, you know, dike walls or earthen walls. And I guess what struck me is the fact that these the batter, if you will, rose 55 feet above the ground. So it was a huge amount of material. And from the ground, you can't necessarily see the scope of it other than how tall it is, but they would essentially pour it into this retaining cell. And so then what happened last Monday was that one of those walls of the cake pan essentially disintegrated, and all that material, 55 feet tall, came spilling out into the surrounding area and even residential area.
So this is a matter of overtopping, not a failure of one of the retaining walls, or is it both?
Well, no, I don't believe it was overtopping, and TVA said that their stability analysis had showed that it could even have gone higher. They don't know why this wall failed, and obviously once the cleanup is done, that's going to be, I'm sure, a major focus of their attention is figuring out why a wall that was supposed to be in perfectly good shape did fail, and what caused this.
Well, I'm down with your cake pan analogy there, Josh. Josh Flory is a reporter for the Knoxville News Sentinel. He talked with us from the studios of WUOT, public radio station in Knoxville, Tennessee. And now, headlines from Femi Okay.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, Egypt's president says he will not open its crossing into the Gaza Strip unless Mahmoud Abbas is in control. Egypt opposes Hamas's role in governing Gaza. They have allowed some wounded people to cross over for treatment since the Israeli offensive began on Saturday. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says that other countries need to get involved in the Gaza situation and help bring about a peaceful resolution.
I think the regional and international partners have not done enough. They should do more.
Some 360 Palestinians have been killed and four Israelis since the attacks began 4 days ago. The Treasury Department will pump up to $6 billion into GMAC. That's the financial arm of General Motors. The Fed approved GMAC's application to become a bank holding company last week. The Pakistan Army is preparing an attack against insurgents in the northwest. They closed a major supply road through the Khyber Pass to prepare for the attack. And Western troops in Afghanistan rely on the route for up to 75% of their supplies. And it's not clear how long the assault will last. And that's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adore Udoji. There's no let-up in the political turmoil in Thailand. The past year, the country has had four prime ministers. The latest, newly elected prime minister's first speech, which is mandatory for him to take office, was delayed twice by thousands of protesters.
Our goal is to get the prime minister and the cabinet to endorse the will of so many people today in regaining a democratically elected government, not a government which is conceived by a tricky process like this one.
The incoming prime minister managed to give the speech today at an improvised parliament session. BBC correspondent Jonathan Head joined us earlier from Bangkok to tell us what the new prime minister said.
Well, it was an important speech because he has an enormous task on his hands. Abhisit Vejachiwa knows his mandate is questioned. Remember, he got this job by all sorts of wheeling and dealing behind the scenes. He's setting out some very clear policies, first of all, to address the most enormous economic challenge. This is a country that is more than 60% dependent on exports. You can just imagine how they're being hit by the global slowdown, plus the impact of all this turmoil, the fact the international airport was shut down last month. And he has this immense political division between supporters and opponents of his government. And he's promised he focused very much on reconciliation. But perhaps the most striking thing of all about it was, you know, the circumstances in which he had to deliver it in a hastily convened, improvised parliamentary session in the foreign ministry. And that's a sign of how desperate he was to get this speech done. He's given himself only 2 to 3 months to show results, to prove that he's earned the job of Prime Minister. After that, he says, I would accept the fact that I would have to resign. And, of course, Thailand would then have to look for another Prime Minister. So he set himself a very tough task in these very unfavourable circumstances to win over his critics and those large crowds of people outside the Parliament today who believe he doesn't have a mandate and that he got the job by stealth.
Well, that's the question. Even though he's given himself this very short window, are these protesters going to stop protesting long enough to accept that, given the fact, as one of the protesters said in that soundbite, that he called it a tricky process by which the prime minister got the job to begin with? Are they going to be able to move beyond that, those protesters?
Well, there's a lot of anger. It's worth remembering the previous government, although it performed very badly, still has a huge groundswell of support among rural people who loved the old Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, a man who was thrown out by the coup 2 years ago, but still has a very powerful presence here. And they felt robbed, the government of his allies being pushed out by a series of court decisions, near army mutinies, and then that airport occupation. There's one thing you need to remember, though. Those protesters today, very passionate, wearing red shirts, remember, not the yellow shirts we saw of the previous group of protesters, the ones who occupied the airport. They're not as well organised. They're very orderly in terms of following the orders of their leaders. They're not as aggressive. They simply don't have the kind of focus that the yellow-shirted protesters had in driving out the previous government. There's certainly Mr. Abhisit is going to face considerable opposition and scepticism, but I don't think he has some crucial advantages. He's got the army on his side. Mm-hmm. He's got the traditional elite linked to the palace on his side. He won't face the degree of insurrection and lawlessness that the previous government had to deal with.
Jonathan Head reports for the BBC. Thank you. And he spoke to us from Thailand, from Bangkok, Thailand.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 30th, and Femi Okeh has joined us with the latest headlines.
Hello there. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. 2008 is ending with a string of winter weather troubles. In the Midwest, they're bracing for floods. Here's Daniel Cobb with the National Weather Service on the situation in Michigan.
We have 13 warnings out for various river forecast points, mostly along the Grand River, which is the river that flows through Grand Rapids.
Now, besides Michigan, several other Midwest states could also flood. And there's been a record-breaking amount of snow hitting Spokane, Washington. The roof of a supermarket collapsed under the weight of it, and many residential roads remained clogged. John Hockenberry, I'm mad with you. You made me say Spokane last hour.
Spokane. I almost corrected you.
Yeah, you did. You just laughed.
No, I didn't.
You laughed as I continued reading the story.
It just went by so fast. Oh. I have friends in Spokane.
It's okay. You can correct me. No, I don't mind that.
I'm glad we're getting this out now.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
I know.
It's a really beautiful
moment. I was stewing. Okay. Meanwhile, back to
news.
The news.
Yeah, news.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we have two wars raging and other threats looming, and the U.S. Marines are hiring. And to their surprise, they've met their recruiting goals twice as fast as expected. They've grown by 27,000 in just 2 years. Top Marines credit bigger bonuses and more recruiters for their success. The trial of the Iraqi journalist who threw shoes at President Bush is on hold. The justice system now wants a higher court to look at his case before the trial. Now, he's currently charged with assaulting a foreign leader. His lawyers want the charge lowered to insulting a foreign leader. Now, if the appeals court reduces the charge, he could be eligible for bail. And that's a look at some stories making news this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi. You have a few days left to do some shopping and perhaps help retailers make up for a dismal sales year. What would get you into the store?
I'm Andy Ball. I live in Illinois. What it would take to get me out and shopping is a new job.
Well, there's his story. We'd like to hear yours. Why aren't you shopping? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
We've been reporting all morning about the situation in Gaza, but what are the military objectives, military or otherwise, any objectives for Israel and Hamas? Perhaps more importantly, what are the opportunities for governments, the United Nations, or regional players to jump in and attempt to reestablish some kind of brokering arrangement? The failure of Egypt to mediate between Hamas and Israel is one cause of the latest breakdown. And Daniel Levy, who is director of the New America Foundation's Middle East Initiative, joins us. He's a senior fellow and director of Prospects for Peace. It's an initiative at the Century Foundation. And he was one of the negotiators in the Oslo process back before the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Daniel Levy, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, John.
You are on the line from Washington. Let me just begin by saying, from my perspective, this looks like a battle between two equal and opposite power vacuums. The Israeli government is getting ready for elections. Hamas, of course, is fighting for its own legitimacy within the broader Palestinian movement. Do you see it as two power vacuums that really need to assert their credibility and are doing it militarily here?
I think that's a very perceptive way of looking at it. Of course, this has its immediate triggers that led to this, the end of the ceasefire. But why we're seeing this happen rooted in where the domestic politics are on both sides and in the regional situation. A lot of your listeners may say, oh, Israelis and Arabs are shooting each other. Wow, what's new? I think what's new is just how dangerously destabilized the Middle East is in terms of the backdrop against which this is happening. There are demonstrations right across the region. The street, the public are angry, and the fragile regimes that we call moderate and that we call allies are feeling very, very vulnerable right now. The streets aren't with them, and that really matters for America, because this is a region in which America is deeply invested and which we've seen just how immediately that can affect American security. And America is also being blamed for what's going on, unfortunately.
Well, Daniel Levy, does that street reaction, as you describe it, and we've already heard demonstrations from Damascus this morning, does that encourage Arab regimes, regional regimes, to stay on the sidelines, or does it encourage them to come in and attempt to broker something? Egypt was in most recently.
Well, they're all very discredited, it has to be said. They are being looked at by their own publics as either complicit or impotent in this. So yes, they want to broker it, but also it encourages them to take steps that only distance themselves further from where the public mood is. Right now, what you will see is an effort to try and move this into a de-escalation and into a ceasefire. But things have escalated so greatly that that will be very difficult to achieve. To get there, you're going to need the regional actors to get involved, not just Egypt. The Egypt-Hamas relationship is a very, very thorny and difficult one and has a lot to do with Egyptian domestic politics. So you'll need other regional actors, but you're also going to need external powers. A big question many in the region are asking is, why is the U.S., understandably still with its Israeli ally, but incapable of displaying any empathy to the other side, and why is the U.S. letting this happen? That's the question that's being asked all around the Arab world.
When you speak about other regional actors, a reporter from the New York Times earlier suggested that perhaps Turkey may be in a position to help facilitate negotiations.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And the news reports this morning suggest that a Turkish effort is already underway. It's very interesting. One of the things that's happened in the last years, it is that another vacuum has existed, which is America has relations and talks to very few of the key actors in the region today, unlike in the past. So you have Turkey filling that vacuum, you have Qatar and others filling that vacuum. What you'll tend to find, though, is in the end, you'll also need America to get involved to bring the Israelis on board.
Well, Daniel Levy, you'll also need Iran to get involved. And, you know, let's talk about a power vacuum there. Does Ahmadinejad get more credibility by stepping up and encouraging Hamas to show restraint in its rocket attacks on Israel, or does Ahmadinejad get more credibility in the region and within Iran by maybe saber-rattling, lobbing a missile, or doing something even more radical?
Well, there's no missiles to be lost from Iran. Iran doesn't border Israel. Iran's not going to go into that kind of an escalatory act. Right now in the region, the mood is that you're seeing the pictures out of Gaza. You're seeing over 350 casualties, over 50 of them are civilians, and no one is scoring any points by calling for too much moderation. So Iran, in Iraq, you've got Sistani and others. All across the region, people are saying, hey, we need to see a response that gets back at Israel. It's not just Iran. I think what it points to, though, is that the only way you're going to be able to restabilize the region is to, difficult as it is, get beyond this simple moderate extremist divide and try and create some kind of grand bargain. Try and bring others into the room. If America can't do that directly, then you'll have to use others. One of the reasons you need Turkey or Qatar to be involved is because America and others don't talk to Hamas.
Well,
they won an election, understandably. Yeah.
Well, Daniel Levy, last question then. If there were, under the new Barack Obama administration, a new dialogue between the U.S. and Iran, might such a dialogue be capable of bringing Hamas and Fatah, the other party in the Palestinian movement, together to create at least a consensus arrangement that would then negotiate with Israel?
I think that's right. If you have a dialogue with Iran where everything is on the table, not just the nuclear issue, not just Iraq, but everything, including Iran's involvement in this issue, then it may encourage and more easy reconciliation within the Palestinian house and putting that Palestinian Humpty Dumpty back together in. Hamas is not Iran's proxy. Iran does have some influence there.
And we'll see where that goes. Daniel Levy is a senior fellow and director of the Middle East Initiative at the New America Foundation. He's also a senior fellow and director of the Prospects for Peace Initiative at the Century Foundation. Thank you very much, Daniel Levy.
And today we're asking you, what would get you into the stores who are facing really slow sales this year?
What would it take to get me into the store? There's nothing the store can do. If there's something in the store that I need, that I know I'm going to need for the next 3 months, but I'm not going to go shopping not knowing what the next 3 months is going to be like economically.
Lots of economic fears. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And on that note, here's one of your takeaways.
If anyone can say there's something of a bright spot anywhere, it has been online.
That's New York Times reporter Stephanie Rosenblum talking about holiday sales. And you know, here's a deal. We have one here at The Takeaway. You got one, and here's another takeaway for free.
The U.S. is really out in the open as the only power, basically blaming Hamas and saying to the Israelis, get on with it.
That's Jim Muir, a BBC correspondent, coming to us from Beirut, Lebanon, speaking on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Very much echoing what Daniel Levy was saying there a moment ago, that you know, there isn't a broker, the region is destabilized, and the longer this goes on, the more kind of out-of-the-box scenarios present themselves.
Which is troubling, like 10 different ways
very much,
from Sunday.
Yes.
We're always on here at The Takeaway. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go, and you can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org, or you can go to iTunes.
You know, I would suggest, if you are a podcaster, it would be an interesting contrast to play the Jim Muir, Ethan Bronner interview and the Daniel Levy. I think that would be a very interesting analysis of the whole region. I'm John Hockenberry.
And informative, too.
Yep.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I don't know, I just felt different when I got out of bed. You know, like there was a gangster inside me.
There's an economic gangster inside of all of us, and if the conditions are right and the institutions are weak, that economic gangster can come out.
Berkeley economist Ed Miguel says all across the world, economic gangsters have been popping out and wreaking havoc. It's an equal opportunity economic reality. Mugabe to Madoff. All roads lead to The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 30th. I'm so glad that you told me that there's a gangster inside of you, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, the latest on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Also, automaker layoffs mean a big hit to the African-American middle class. And personalized medicine, making sure the system is working for you. We'll explain that. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
There's more to come in the fight between Israel and Hamas. The United Nations puts the Palestinian death toll above 360, with many more injured. Riyad Mansour, the Palestinian representative to the UN, wants the bombings to stop.
Stopping this carnage that so far took the life and injured more than 1,700 Palestinians, large number of them civilians, children, women. This is a crime against humanity. We need that to be stopped immediately.
Israel launched the attack to stop Hamas rocket attacks on its civilians. Four Israelis have died in rocket fire since the bombing started. Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev says they aren't done yet.
All the reports were that Hamas was in shock and that Hamas had received very strong blows from us. But we have no doubt that the Hamas military machine is still very much there, that they are still lethal and they're still a problem.
And Israeli officials at all levels of the government are saying its forces are ready for weeks of fighting.
There are reports this morning of a major Pakistani offensive against Islamic militants in the northwest province of Pakistan. Pakistan closed a major supply road to prepare for the attack, and it's not clear how long that assault will last. Here are the states. GMAC, that's GM's financial arm, is getting a $5 billion injection of government money. GMAC takes care of auto loans, hoping to unfreeze those markets. GM proper will get a separate $1 billion loan to invest in GMAC. European markets are mostly up. Asian markets had a fairly good day, with most indexes closing higher. Trading was fairly light, since many investors are done for the year.
And that means the volumes are low, but when Wall Street gets started at the bottom of the hour, the Dow is expected to open positively on the last day of the trade, or the, one of the last days of the trading session. It lost about a third of a percentage point yesterday, closing at 84.83. The S&P was down about the same. It closed at 869. No real consensus in these last day of the year trades. It's more crucial for retailers, who are probably in a worse pinch than the stock markets.
They're not feeling good right
now.
Dismal sales numbers.
Well, I mean, retail analysts are asking themselves this, but we're asking our listeners, what's going to get you back out to the stores? Why are you holding back? Is there anything retailers can do to get you back into the retail economy that's so crucial to their survival? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've been getting some pretty interesting responses this morning.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're watching some disturbing signs out of Gaza and the border around Gaza, both on the southern end and the northern end, where a BBC report says there are military forces, Israeli military forces, massing near the border. And we don't know what that means, and there hasn't been any border crossing, even though reserves have been called up by Israel, and the Israeli government still maintains it has no intention of reoccupying Gaza. But the fighting continues, and Egypt is beginning to react. In a speech today, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak said his country will not fully open the border crossing into Gaza, and it will remain that way until the Palestinian Authority, a difficult concept even in the best of times, is in control of the border post. Joining us live at the Rafah crossing, which is the border post between Gaza and Egypt, is the BBC's Christian Fraser. Christian, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
So is there any Hosni Mubarak said that the post is going to stay closed. I'm wondering if there is a massing of potential refugees who want to cross into Egypt at this point, or are people staying put?
Well, on Sunday, there were Palestinians that came over the perimeter wall, and there were some ugly scenes, clashes between the Egyptian security forces here and Palestinians. One security guard was shot dead, and we believe one Palestinian man was shot dead as well. And since that point, there have been more guards moved up here by the Egyptian government. You're right to say that this border is closed. It's a very lonely walk through the arrival halls, the other side of these gates where I'm standing at the moment. But they have opened the crossing for the most seriously wounded. They took in 36 yesterday. These are people with head trauma, abdominal injuries, they're missing limbs. And we've taken in quite a few today while we've been there filming some of them come across. A lot of them were young men, but also there was a young boy, perhaps 9 or 10 years of age, who had some very serious burns right across his face, and he looked in a very bad way. But all these people will now be transferred to specialist units within Egypt at the nearby town of Al Arish, which is about half an hour drive from here. Some of them also going to Cairo to specialist trauma units. And it seems difficult to say, but these are the lucky ones, because of course there are some 1,500 people, we're told, that are in need of medical care in Gaza, and really 50 or 60 is only a handful of the people that need this medical help.
Now, there's pressure from Hezbollah for Egypt to open this border, and the president, I think, Hosni Mubarak, is speaking about maintaining its closure as a way of at least projecting to the Egyptian people that it doesn't want a repeat of what happened when the border post was opened and there were so many refugees that crossed some months ago. But, Christian, did you get any sign that the Egyptian president is directly addressing the violence and the fact that Egypt was very, very recently brokering Hamas and Israel?
I think there are two things to bear in mind here. Hamas and the Egyptian government have had a very difficult relationship over the past month. Cairo was trying to liaise between Fatah and Hamas, who, as we know, have been at odds for some 18 months. They were trying to bring them together for reconciliation talks. There was a meeting due to take place in Cairo last month.
That was Christian Fraser, who's the BBC Middle East correspondent. He was live at the Rafah crossing describing a situation where wounded are being taken into Egyptian hospitals, both near the border in Al Arish and also in Cairo, and that President Hosni Mubarak has just given a speech saying that his country will not fully open the border crossing into Gaza, emphasizing the very difficult relationship that Hamas has with Egypt. And as we know, the fighting began when the ceasefire that was brokered by the Egyptians between Hamas and Israel broke down then on Saturday, the fighting actually began. Adora?
And interesting, one report we had yesterday was talking about how many Palestinians were actually blaming Egypt for the turmoil that is now taking place on Gaza.
They're not an option at this point to broker any sort of new ceasefire right now. Something else will have to happen.
We're going to come back here to the U.S., and we're going to talk about the auto industry. News today that GMAC, the funding side of the business, is going to get a $5 billion check from the federal government to help unfreeze credit woes. But right now, as we know, the U.S. car industry is suffering, and the layoffs have been hitting African-American workers particularly hard. Not long ago, African-Americans found more closed doors than work, but Ford Motor Company, for example, was one company that early on gave them African-Americans jobs and a road to the middle class. Mary Chapman, who's a contributor to the New York Times, has reported this story for today's newspaper. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
I'm struck by the numbers in your reporting. In manufacturing, 13.9% decline for African-American workers, but only a 4.4% decline for white workers. Explain what's happening.
Well, yes. I mean, so those numbers show that African-Americans are almost three times as affected by this automotive downturn as any other group. And the scope is vast and far-reaching. We're talking about a huge chunk of America's black middle class here. And all blacks made up 14.2% of the total automotive workforce last year. And that compares with 11.2% of the overall American workforce.
Well, let's describe the relationship here. We can really go back to the 40s when Ford was one of the few manufacturing companies, if not the only one then, who would actually employ African Americans.
Exactly. I mean, hundreds of thousands of African Americans left sharecropping jobs and other occupations of that nature for the promise of $5 a day, as proposed by Henry Ford. And they just couldn't make that money anywhere else, and that still holds true today for less educated African Americans.
Which is really an extraordinary thought if you think about it. We're talking about 60 years ago, but yet and still in these manufacturing jobs, we're not just talking about the salary, but also the kinds of benefits it offers, right? The car manufacturers and their related companies offer.
Yes. You're looking at Nelson White. I interviewed him for our story as an example of a sort of white-collar success story. This is a guy who started out on the production line, and he went to school via a tuition plan paid by Ford Motor Company. He is now a salaried executive. He is about to receive a master's degree. He has bought a home. And he has benefited from the company and greatly, and he's afraid that his peers won't have that same opportunity.
You know, one of the sad things about reading your story, Mary, is that in some ways we are seeing the epitaph of that feature of the U.S. economy where you could get a job without, you know, a Ph.D., and raise a family and afford a home and basically have a life that would support an entire family. That is almost no longer possible. And so these are some of the last jobs where it was.
Well, listen, as I say, 21.9% of black workers in the nation's overall workforce have college degrees. That compares with 33.7% of whites in the entire labor force. So to put it bluntly, some of these African Americans will not be able to make this kind of money anywhere else.
And so what does that do to the community as a whole when you talk about the numbers who have moved into the middle class in the last several decades? Does it decimate those numbers?
I'm sorry?
Does it decimate those numbers of African Americans in the middle class?
Well, I mean, look, you're talking about, if you look at the supplier with whom I spoke in my story, this guy has 60% of his employees are black. So it's not so the tentacles are incredibly far-reaching. It's going to be devastating to a city like Detroit, which is 80% black in the first place. But these are the African Americans who bought the rental homes, who bought the second cars, who opened the bars and the restaurants. I mean, it's the devastation is already being felt around here.
Is there any shining light here at all?
Well, with the possible dealer loans coming through, that could possibly help a bit with some of the dealerships and as well as the suppliers. But you know, dealers and suppliers, as I say, are at a disadvantage to begin with because 95% of dealers, as I say in my story, are first-generation owners. So they don't have
the kind of relationships that would sustain them.
Exactly.
Mary Chapman, many thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
Mary Chapman is a contributor to our partner, The New York Times, and she spoke to us from Detroit.
You know, one of the things Mary didn't say but was clear from what she was talking about, the tax base in Detroit also completely destroyed
by that enormous
erosion of the middle class. Only a few more days for retailers to make up for a dismal sales year. What's keeping you from shopping? Mike has one suggestion.
I think in particular Victoria's Secret should have live models rather than these mannequins that you see modeling the outfits. That would definitely draw me, and I'd be happy to spend plenty of money. Thank you.
Sort of an endocrine suggestion for boosting the economy, a different kind of stimulus package there at Victoria's Secret. Thank you, Mike. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. This story now is very important to your health, and it has to do with drugs. Most drugs, you may or may not know, only work for about half the people who take them. And why is that? That's because our individual genes dictate how well they will or will not work. However, there might be a way around this biological problem, and it's called personalized medicine. Here to tell us more is Andrew Pollack, a reporter for the New York Times in Los Angeles. He has an article today on the front page talking about personalized medicine. Andrew, why don't we start with the obvious? Good morning, and what is personalized medicine?
Well, personalized medicine is, well, it's probably a bit of a misnomer since all medicine is personalized to some extent. I mean, your doctor tries to tell what disease you have and treat it accordingly, but this would go another step and try to use mainly genetic testing to figure out which drug would be best for which patient, which would have the greatest effectiveness, and which drugs should be avoided by particular patients because they would have a higher risk of side effects.
And you talk about the example of tamoxifen, which does two things. One, it shows what kind of difference it could make if you are given the drug that your body is most likely to respond to. And two, all of the obstacles that exist in the medical system today to moving forward with this personalized medicine.
That's correct. There are potentially great payoffs from personalized medicine, but there are significant obstacles that we're finding. It's very difficult to often to tease out the effect of a particular genetic variant on response to a drug. And there is, the drug companies are sometimes reluctant to develop tests or encourage testing because it might limit the sales of their drugs. Doctors sometimes, particularly with drugs like tamoxifen that they've been prescribing for years or even decades, they sometimes say, well, I've been doing it successfully for decades.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need the test. Insurers are...
But the point is, it doesn't work for everyone, and there is a way to test to determine whether or not your body is one of those that would respond well to tamoxifen. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. But even there's, the obstacle to proving that that's the case.
What accounts for the variability, Andrew? I mean, is it a matter that genetics is so complex and that drugs are relatively simple molecules compared to DNA? Or are genes in some way actively trying to inhibit all kinds of foreign substances and that, pharmacology is a bit of a tricking process to get around switches that are blocking entrance to various substances that might help us?
Well, I think, everyone's body is different. In the case of tamoxifen, the gene that people are interested in is involved with breaking down tamoxifen, which by itself is not active, into the active substance that actually fights cancer, in this case mainly used to prevent a return of breast cancer after a woman has had her tumor removed by surgery. Some women's have a gene that produces a very active enzyme that turns tamoxifen into the active substance. Others have genes that produce inactive enzymes, so the tamoxifen does not get turned into the active substance, so they are getting no benefit. In other cases, your genetic variability might determine how the drug binds to its target in the body. In other cases, your genes determine how quickly your body gets rid of the drug.
Uh-huh.
If you get rid of it too quickly, you might not get any effect.
So it's a full range.
It's
a full range of genetic impacts. Well, how interested is the FDA in bringing genetic variables into the whole matter of determining whether a drug is effective at all or not?
Well, the FDA, I think, is very interested in this because, more better targeted medicine would potentially have fewer side effects and be more effective.
And more cost-effective, but certainly not something that the pharmaceutical companies would necessarily like to see, because that would require them then, right, to do more kinds of research, which costs them more money.
Yes, it does cost them more money. And one big worry they had is that if their drug is only to be given to someone who has, you know, a particular genetic variant, that limits the sales of the drug. They'd rather sell it to everyone, even if it only works for some of the people. However, I should point out that is starting to change. The drug companies are starting to realize that in some cases they won't be able to get a drug approved, or they won't be able to get insurers to pay for the drug unless it's better targeted at people for whom the drug will work. And there's an example in the story of a cancer drug that was developed by Amgen, the biotechnology company, which had, you know, sort of modest effectiveness. The European regulator said it's not effective enough for us to approve.
Right.
Amgen went back, reanalyzed their data, and found that for people whose tumors for people whose tumors had a certain mutation, the drug didn't work at all.
So these are big questions about disease, treating disease, and how drugs are going to do that, and certainly something we'll be looking towards in 2009. Andrew Pollack, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Andrew Pollack is a reporter for the New York Times, and he is based in Los Angeles. And now we turn to Femi Oke with the headlines.
And the time is 28 minutes past the hour. The death count in the Israeli offensive against Gaza continues to rise. It's over 370. Most are members of Hamas security forces, but the United Nations says that at least 64 were civilians. And today, Israeli warplanes struck a Hamas government complex and the home of a top militant commander. The Treasury Department will provide up to $6 billion to GMAC. That's the financial arm of General Motors. And the Fed approved GMAC's application to become a bank holding company last week. And that made it eligible to funds from the Financial Rescue Fund. And jazz trumpeter Freddie Hubbard died yesterday in Los Angeles. We're listening to Fee, Fi, Fo, Fum. It's a track from Wayne Shorter's album Speak No Evil. The Grammy-winning jazz musician influenced a whole generation of trumpet players, and Hubbard played on hundreds of recordings dating back to 1958, and his last recording was this year.
He died. Amazing energy, and also just a gorgeous trumpet voice that he could project in slow songs.
I'm going to stop talking, and you can listen to him.
Stuff.
Freddie Hubbard, dead at 70.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. On this Tuesday, December 30th, we're following the latest developments in Gaza, and so are you.
My takeaway is simple. It's not that there was a breakdown in the ceasefire. It's that Hamas called off the ceasefire, and that's why there's violence in the Middle East now. Is it an appropriate response? Well, as usual, that's a question that's going to be answered many ways.
We're also talking about holiday shopping today, only a few more days for retailers to make up for a sad, sad sales year. But consumers aren't buying. Tell us what would get you to the stores and what's keeping you from them. Loveless writes on our site, I'm a big consumer of fashion. I've curtailed my spending because of poor designs, quality, and fit. And if there's something I do like, it's priced ridiculously. $300 for a pair of ballet-like flat shoes? No thanks. Well, what about you? Why aren't you shopping? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
So maybe it's because there's an economic gangster loose in the world, as we spoke about at the top of the hour, and not just in places like Congo, Somalia, or, say, Zimbabwe, where there is a political stalemate plus hyperinflation and rampant government corruption. Now, we may think that those are the kinds of things that don't happen in a more functional economy, say, for instance, the United States, but we would be wrong. In a new book, Economic Gangsters, Corruption, Violence, and the Poverty of Nations, it appears that the motivations of someone like Mobutu in Zaire years ago and Bernard Madoff and the billions that he stole from investors all over the world are actually much more similar than we might think. Co-author of this book is Edward Miguel. He's an economist at the University of California, Berkeley. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
How would you say that corruption in both the kind of white-collar, ultra-rich world of the financial system in, marketplace capitalism is similar to the kinds of corruptions we see in emerging nations?
Well, the thing that's similar about them is really human nature. Human beings try to make money and fill their wallet wherever they are. And in the case of somebody like Mobutu in Congo, that consisted of stealing foreign aid money, that consisted of skimming money off the state budget. In the case of Bernard Madoff, it consisted of stealing his investors' money. But the fundamental human incentives and human behaviors and human psychology are the same. So we can use the same kinds of tools of economics to understand them both. That's really the central premise of the book, is that economic analysis allows us to gain new insights, both in rich countries and in poor.
Now, to simply say that human nature explains corruption both on the high and the low end of the scale, or the emerging nation and the industrialized end of the scale, is only part of the story. We've had economists on this program critique the compensation strategies of banks and financial institutions as a kind of a skimming scheme that channels lots and lots of money into bankers' pockets. Would you say that the way those schemes work actually looks suspiciously like the way someone like Mugabe or Mobutu skimmed money off of all kinds of services being performed by his government in interaction with other countries?
Well, I think there are similarities. I think the thing that sets the U.S. apart, or rich countries apart, from less developed countries very often are the sorts of legal institutions and regulatory institutions that constrain behavior. But if the institutions are set up in a way that makes it profitable for people to steal, people in rich and poor countries will very often act the same way. And the title of our book, Economic Gangsters, really captures that idea. There's an economic gangster inside of all of us, and if the conditions are right and the regulations are weak, the institutions are weak, that economic gangster could come out.
Can you explain further what you mean by constrained behavior? We can look at nearly every decade in the United States, and there has been an enormous corruptive scale, a corruption that had to do with people in business. So when you say constrained behavior, in what way? How was Madoff, for example, constrained?
Well, you know, the regulatory environment is going to be very important. The regulatory environment in the U.S., say in the financial sector, has actually changed a lot over the last few decades. You can do a lot more. You have a lot more flexibility today than you did a few decades ago. So somebody like Madoff may not have existed under a more stringent regulatory scheme. It's actually a very troubling development. You know, our book focuses mainly on less developed countries, and we focus on poor countries in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. We focus on the actions of their leaders, who are often very corrupt. Now, over the last 6 months, there have been an increasing number of political and financial corruption scandals in the U.S. that really just show how universal these problems are.
You've got to write a new chapter. Well, quickly before we go, how do you distinguish between someone who is fundamentally corrupt and someone who is simply in an operation where, hey, it's legal, everybody else is taking the money, you know, why shouldn't I get mine?
That's a very good question. One of the issues that we talk about a lot in the book is a culture of corruption that can develop, where otherwise good people, when caught up in that culture, can behave in a way that is very corrupt. So in the New York area, think of the Long Island Railroad scandal that developed this past summer, where I think it was 95-98% of retirees claimed disability.
It's that culture of corruption that is the narrative for economic gangsters, corruption, violence, and the poverty of nations. Co-author of that book is Edward Miguel, and he's a professor of economics at the University of California at Berkeley, and his co-author was Raymond Fisman. That book gets great, great reviews, including from Stephen Levitt of Freakonomics. And now, headlines from our own Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says that the airstrikes against Hamas in Gaza are, and I'm going to quote him here, the first of several phases of attack. New York Times correspondent Tagri El-Kadri is in Gaza. I spoke to her this morning when she told me how the residents of Gaza are faring 4 days into the attacks.
People are very confused, in a state of shock, traumatized. They don't know where it's going. They cannot predict what's coming. There is no electricity. Israel, after the bombing yesterday, they hit, it affected all the electricity system. So there is no electricity at all in Gaza City.
And it's the fourth consecutive day of the Israeli offensive against Gaza. Four Israelis and more than 370 Palestinians have died. Lawyers are advising families of children sickened by tainted milk in China to reject a government compensation package. They say the amount offered is far too low. Now, according to state media, children who suffered from kidney stones would get $290, while families of those who died would each receive $29,000. The payment would come from the 22 companies blamed in the scandal. Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin is now a grandmother. Her daughter Bristol gave birth to a son who's called Trip on Saturday, and that news comes courtesy of People magazine. And the governor's office said it would not release information because it considers the birth to be a private matter.
People magazine is the authority on who's a grandmother or not?
Who's a celebrity grandmother.
A celebrity grandmother.
There is no other source, John.
I see.
Yes. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has signed a law extending presidential terms from 4 to 6 years. It's the final endorsement of legislation that was quickly approved by Parliament. That's a look at some stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And on the last trading session of 2008, the Japan Nikkei Stock Index managed to close out the month of December with an increase of about 4.5%. Which would be a fine story, but not much of one, except it is the only bit of positive news in the worst year in Nikkei history in Japan. The Nikkei average finished the year down 42%, the worst annual performance ever. Andrew Walker, BBC business and economics correspondent, joined us from London earlier, and I asked him, what story does this 42% dip in the Nikkei tell about the Japanese economy?
Well, it tells a story mainly, not exclusively, but mainly of flagging economic performance in the rest of the world. Japanese consumers have not been big on expanding their spending for quite some time, and certainly continued weakness of Japanese consumer confidence is part of that story. But it's really about exports to the United States, to Europe, and actually to other parts of Asia as well, where economies haven't actually gone into recession the way they have in North America and Europe, but certainly are growing much more slowly. And so Japan, being dependent for its growth as it has been on exports, has seen that external markets slip back. And inevitably, that's been reflected in deteriorating profits for its businesses. And that, in turn, has been reflected in this very bad year, indeed, for share prices.
So you would expect the year in which Toyota lost money for the first time in, I guess, something like 81 years would also be the worst year for the Nikkei.
Yeah, and actually the car sector was one particularly bad performer. Toyota's down by around half. Some of the other car makers are down even more. And I must say, you know, personally, when I first heard that Toyota talking about losses, one was kind of used to hearing about losses at Ford and General Motors, but hearing it coming from Toyota was something that frankly made my jaw drop.
For the first time in 71
yeah.
years,
yeah.
actually.
71 years, yeah, it's yeah. a long, long time. Well, the Nikkei is at 88.60 right now. Remind us in the minute and a half or so before we go what the good old days were like for the Nikkei.
That's an awfully long time ago, I have to say. Bear in mind that the Nikkei did not have the boom of the 1990s, the technology boom that we had in the United States and in some European markets. The peak was actually 19 years ago, and from that peak, the Nikkei is down a total of more than 70%. The Nikkei had its big boom back in the 1980s with some extraordinary increases in share prices and an enormous real estate bubble. That came to an end at the end of the decade, and Japan has never recovered, and the Japanese stock market at least has never recovered from that experience.
And we all can remember reporting on Japan was going to take over. The entire world is shifting to the Pacific. I mean, it is amazing how things and fortunes can so quickly shift in this global economy.
It didn't take very long, did it, before we had to start thinking again, and
suddenly
we were trying to learn lessons from Japan about how not to do things. Well, maybe that Trans-Pacific flow in lessons is turning round once again.
Indeed.
But, you know, for sure, Japan is in for a difficult period one way or another.
And maybe it's China's turn now. Andrew Walker, BBC Business and Economics correspondent, reporting on the worst year ever for Japan's Nikkei stock index, down 42%.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 30th, and Femi Oke is here with the headlines of the morning.
Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Israel's soldiers, tanks, and artillery are all standing by very close to Palestinian territory. Hamas rocket attacks haven't stopped completely. So Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev says that the battle isn't over yet.
All the reports were that Hamas was in shock and that Hamas had received very strong blows from us. But we have no doubt that the Hamas military machine is still very much there, that they are still lethal and they're still a problem.
Now, the United Nations says that more than 370 Palestinians have died, four Israelis so far. And the UN Secretary General called on both Israel and Hamas to stop the fight and end civilian deaths. The trial of the Iraqi journalist who threw shoes at President Bush is on hold. The justice system now wants a higher court to look at his case before trial. Now, he's currently charged with assaulting a foreign leader, and his lawyers want the charge lowered to insulting a foreign leader. And if the appeals court reduces the charge...
What's the difference between those two?
Well, assault is if I throw my microphone at you, and an insult is I don't like red very much and you, I don't think it's a good colour on you.
And one's a ticket and the other is the death penalty.
Yeah, right. So it's a difference between being rude and being physical. That's the difference.
And I love how they keep you in prison while they figure out what the charge is.
Yes,
that's
still deciding that one.
Concept.
Huh.
Yeah.
But it's in his interest if it turns into an insult rather than an assault. I think so.
Is it perfectly legal to throw shoes at President Bush in the United States?
I doubt it. Hmm. No, I'm sure you get yourself into a lot of trouble. One more story for you. The Library of Congress announced this morning 25 films being added to the National Film Registry, including Hallelujah from 1929 that had an all-African-American cast, and also The Terminator from 1994. And that's Look at Your News for now.
Thank you, Femi. Well, the birth of the Internet came with predictions for the end of the media as we know it. And for decades, anyone in this business has had to endure smug, self-serving predictions that the shrinking staffs of newspapers and radio and television means that the media's demise is nearby. Well, it hasn't happened yet, but it's possible that the combination of significant shifts in technology plus the latest economic downturn may constitute something of a critical mass for changes in the upcoming year in the media. We've seen bankruptcies of significant media companies as well as transformative technology rushing to market. Siva Vaidyanathan, who's an associate professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, joins us to talk about all of this. Thanks for joining us, Siva.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Is it possible that this is the critical mass of changes, if not in the media, because there's more media than ever before, but certainly in the business model for traditional media?
Yeah, there's undeniably a shift in the sort of the foundations of business. And that was going on pre-recession. One of the things we've seen over the last few years is that advertisers are making very rational decisions that the Sunday newspaper circular is not as good a payoff as buying some Google AdWords, right? So those sorts of shifts have been steadily worrying people in the media industries. But that doesn't mean, as you said, that doesn't mean we're going without, you know, intelligent commentary or insightful and polyphonic voices about what's going on in the world. We have more information and more media than ever before. The real question is, can we continue to support the really heavy, expensive, high-quality work, right? Like a Frontline documentary or a Cy Hirst doing a huge, 10,000-word piece in The New Yorker. Are those sorts of really essential elements of our public sphere not long for this world, because those things come out of a surplus that we've generated by our consumerism. We tend to forget this, like the fact that we spend so much on beer and cars then helps companies like General Motors and Miller and Budweiser support things like foundations and things like public television and public radio shows as underwriters, right? So there are lots of different ways that the strong economy we have enjoyed for 50 years has generated this really brilliant surplus, which has made us all sort of smarter and wiser. So
they also support traditional for-profit media in terms of advertising. And I guess the question is, how much of that goes away? And does the expensive media that you talk about here, is that exclusively the authoritative, high-quality media? Or is there a certain amount of surplus and excess spending in the media, kind of like, the salary cap in baseball or football or something, that can actually reduce the cost of high-quality media?
Yeah, there may be. And, I think people have been experimenting with that for a good decade now. The best example is Talking Points Memo, right, which is doing really high quality investigative work and broad assessments of the American political scene with relatively low overhead, although I'm sure Josh Marshall's overhead seems to increase every day as he hires more people, right? But he's still doing it a lot cheaper than USA Today is doing it, but he's doing a different job, right? So you can find these niches, especially in politics, which really isn't hard to cover, these niches really growing under these new models. But we really have to worry about whether we are going to lose the really smart, foundational, big pieces that take months to work on or years to write a book. Remember, American publishing is also in a crisis, not just because they've been bought up by multinational corporations going for the bottom line and wishing everybody could be a Stephen King, right? All those stupid decisions made by the accountants and the lawyers at the highest levels of publishing have trickled down to hurt authors and editors who actually want to do good work, right? That's happened. But we also are seeing impending shrinking of library budgets at every level. And that's going to decimate publishing in ways that we haven't even begun to examine.
So do you think in part it's about the vehicle as opposed to what the organization, the content that they're generating? In other words, you talk about foundations that perhaps these media outlets should really set themselves up under that model and still be able to deliver some of those big, longer-term, more in-depth projects that you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. We have to recognize that not-for-profits and foundations are really an important part of our media environment. You have big, important magazines like Harper's and The Nation that are foundation-driven, and you have public radio at every level, definitely foundation-driven, and public television foundation-driven. Now, all of these foundations are seeing their endowment shrink along with everybody else's retirement account. So
yeah, they're all
it's
in
not
crisis.
Like there's a lot of money there.
I mean, yeah, NPR announced layoffs in the last month. I mean, it's crazy.
Exactly. So it's not like any aspect of the economy is going to be untouched. And we have to really start asking ourselves, as a democratic republic, are we now seeing the sort of ebbing of pretty enlightened age? And are we going to find ourselves struggling to find that really high quality work in the future? And what can we do to stem it? And for all those reasons, I think it's important that the incoming administration take a significant long-term view toward cultural and information policy in ways that, and see what little and hopefully inexpensive ways the state, the government can help deaden the impact of this recession / depression.
You're talking about Writers Project, like in the Depression?
You know, I don't think that that's a particularly wise idea right now. Mark Prinsky, a writer for the New Republic Online, put out an article in December in which he advocated a new federal Writers Project with some tweaks to sort of update it. I don't think that's the right approach. I don't think we need a brand new program to help, you know, a bunch of Harvard grads who happen to be making less money than they did before. I don't think that's the prime way to support this, what's going to be an increasingly failed market. I think what we need is to bolster the sorts of institutions we have that are operating rather well. For all of the controversy, the fact is the NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, libraries at every level, public, community college, university and college libraries, those libraries are one of the biggest markets for so much of this material. We really have to defend those budgets first and foremost, and I think actually invest more heavily in Corporation for Public Broadcasting specifically.
Yeah, we're going to hate that idea. That's right.
I know, right?
We're definitely going to hate that. Well, see, but we got to go, but it sounds like a stimulus package for the entire broad media industry is the
but
sort
I,
of...
I wouldn't call it that. I wouldn't call it a stimulus package. I would call it a bit of a life raft, right? I think it's much more important that we not think of this as stimulating the economy, which is a totally different concept and a very important concept and one that ultimately will help fix the rest of our problems in society. That's the idea of stimulus. What's really happening here is the recognition that over the next 5 years, we could be losing some really important institutions in this country that we're going to be very sorry about when we see them go.
No, we may lose them in January.
We have to take a very strong position on it.
Well, Siva Vaidyanathan is Associate Professor of Media Studies at the University of Virginia, where he hands out life rafts to all things media.
Earlier, we reported about an internet retailer of children's products, the parent company, becoming the first well-known retailer to file for Chapter 11 after Christmas. Now, there are only a few more days for retailers to make up for the dismal sales year that essentially led to the parent companies having to reorganize. Tell us, what would it take to get you into the store? Tell us at our website, thetakeaway.org. You can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're also following the latest on Gaza, and we're hearing from you, too.
I wish we could just figure out what our role is as the United States and not just to support people who want to kill people. And it doesn't matter what the history is at this point. People are dying.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.